If there's a place you gotta go, I'm the one you need to know. I'm the map. I'm the map, I'm the map. If there's a place you gotta get, I can get you there, I bet. I'm the map.
That's the map from the kids' show Dora the Explorer. Dora and her friend Boots rely on their friend, the map, to get them where they're going and to understand the world they live in. Dora and Boots aren't alone. Maps, from stone etchings to satellite renderings, have guided humans for thousands of years. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. It's 7 minutes after 10 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour loves maps. He's Simon Garfield, author of a number of books, including Just My Type, a book about fonts. His new book, On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. Simon Garfield, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rob.
Well, now, your liner notes of your book tell me that at your home, you are surrounded by old maps on the wall. What map are you looking up at now as you're talking to us?
Okay, well, they are in the hall, and I'm in my office.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Downstairs, I have, the hall is actually made smaller because on both sides I've got maps of the London Underground, and it's really a coincidence that that's what I collect. But that was also really what got me interested in maps in the first place, and the first map that I looked at every day when I went to school was the London Tube map. And even though I only went actually one stop, and it took me 3 minutes, you can't help but look at this map because it's inside the carriages and it's also outside on the walls. It seemed like the most sort of exotic thing, really. Even though I went through one very, very small part of it, the idea of going to the end of the Piccadilly line or the Metropolitan line was sort of as exotic to me as going to Antarctica or somewhere. So I was kind of fascinated by the possibility of maps, you know, not only how they help us get from A to B, but also the places that we could go if we had the time or the energy or the money. At the age of 10, I was never quite sure what one was thinking. But I think in my subconscious, I must have thought about the man who made that map. And it turned out, unbeknownst to me then, that, you know, his map was in a way copied all over the world, not just for underground systems, but also as a kind of perfect example of how to represent quite a complex geographical idea in a very simple and direct way. And the London Underground is it's sort of geographically inaccurate because it looks as if, you know, every single stop is the same, is only, you know, 2 minutes apart, and actually some go from 30 seconds to four minutes. And it also looks like they're all really very much next door to each other. And of course, anyone who's been to London will know that that's not the case. So I think from there, and so that's really why I've got all those on my wall, and they go from 1908 up until a couple of years ago.
Now, I've always liked maps, too, and as a kid, I covered the walls of my room with maps, just whatever National Geographic maps happened to be lying around. I never knew why I liked them, but here's a line from your book that maybe answers that. Maps fascinate us because they tell stories. How do maps tell us stories?
Well, I mean, really, that's exactly what the sort of book is about. You know, I was aware that maps have a way, even in a small map, you know, be it a National Geographic map that you fold out, you know, six times and then can never quite fold together again, you know, the way it was, or small maps, or just huge things you see in the walls of museums. They are very, in a way, I think, you know, they can tell as much as a great historical novel or a great biography. So they tell us stories about the period in which they were made. They tell us a lot about the people who made them and their ambitions, and were they being totally honest? Were they representing the, you know, if it was a landowner, did they also put in the other person's land? Did they, you know, aggregate what they really owned? And then, of course, you know, you go back to the great sort of period of golden exploration in the 15th and the 16th century, the world opening up with the great, you know, Portuguese and Spanish and other European explorers. And they tell us the story of how the world grew and how our knowledge of it grew, how our trade routes grew. And then up to the present day as well. You know, I'm looking at, I don't know, maybe not quite the present day, but I'm looking at sort of Victorian England and maps of poverty and how a map helped to eradicate cholera from London and you know, all those kind of things. And you know, even I talk a little bit in the book about the... you know, the gridding of Manhattan and the Lewis and Clark maps, you know, opening up the West. So all of those things, really, they look like kind of, you know, they look like beautiful things often, and they look like kind of two-dimensional kind of objects. But in fact, if you look into them and you know, you try and find out the stories behind them, you realize that they're, you know, in a way, the best way of telling history, I think.
Talking to Simon Garfield about maps, his new book, On the Map, Why We Love Maps, How We Use Them, the History of Maps. We'll get into that in just a couple moments. I'm interested to hear from you. Do you put up maps on your wall? Do you use them as objects of art? Do you use maps to navigate anymore, or have you cast them aside and used your GPS to tell you where to go? What do you think about that? Map fans or people who are stymied by maps, give a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Rob Ferret, by the way, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on this New Year's Day. Simon Garfield, I want to take a tour of the history of maps a little bit, but first let's start in the present day with a question I just put to our listeners. Is this the end of an era for maps now that we have satellite renderings, GPS, Street View to tell us how to get where we're going?
I think it is. I mean, it's in a way as well, you know, this was the thing that made me think, well, maybe this is the time to do a big collection, a big narrative collection of good map tales. Because in the last, well, effectively the last 10 years, really, you know, since everyone was able to get, you know, free maps on their computers and our phones, and obviously our GPS and our cars, we really treat maps in a totally modern way, and both good and bad. You know, I'm sort of person who will use a GPS in their car, especially if I'm going to a place on my own that I don't really, you know, have never been to before. Certainly safer than trying to, you know, fold a big map myself on a passenger seat. And I will use maps on my phones as well if I'm, you know, if I'm lost in an unfamiliar place. But it also makes me think, well, actually, what we're doing is not just, you know, using maps in a new way, but we're using maps in a narrower way and a more direct way. So it sort of works. Both ways, in a sense. So they're far more useful and they're far more direct if we're just trying to reach, you know, if we're trying to go from our house to, I don't know, a friend's house, a new friend who we haven't met, it's going to be really helpful. It's going to guide us through the shortest route and hopefully tell us a little bit about the traffic on route. And we're going to get there on time, and we're not going to get lost. And that's great. And they're free, you know, most of them, mm-hmm. as well, which is another great thing. What we lose, of course, which old maps provide us, is any sense really of the greater picture, mm-hmm. of, you know, how we, the landmarks that we might see on the way, for instance. And it's possible to get from one end of the country, even cross continents, I think, without really looking up at all. You know, you can just look at a little, you know, plastic and glass box on your windscreen and follow essentially 100 yards ahead. Mm-hmm. And that's all you see. And you don't look up. You've got no idea often of the names of the towns that you're going through because you don't need to. And that clearly must be a great loss. We also, I think, lose a sense of the size of the world and the possibilities of things around us. And I'd say it was a quite sort of egocentric view of the world. The last chapter in the book is called the me mapping of everywhere. And it is that thing that we're at the center of all the maps. You know, it used to be In the Christian world, it was Jerusalem was at the center of the world, or if you lived in China, it was Yuzhu, or if we were, talking with my British hat on, when Britain had an empire, then London would be the center of the world. But now it's just us. You know, it's that little sort of throbbing circle on our maps, and it's sort of as I said, they're kind of very, they orientate us in a very direct way, but I think we lose a lot along the way. And I wonder, you know, we talked at the beginning about how maps tell our history, really. And you look at old digital maps, let's say in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, and obviously they would have improved and they would have expanded and they'll load faster. But will we really be able to get any sense of our history from looking at maps, you know, sort of 10 years ago or even 30 years ago? I don't think we will. And so I think that's another sort of thing that we have to be very wary about. And of course, the last thing is, it's a great, you know, something that, you know, any map fan will nod their head over, is there's just a great joy of looking at maps. Mm-hmm. You know, if you use them to go on a great hiking trek, or if you just use them to sit by the fireside and you know, and dream, really, you know, the possibilities of where one might go, or where one likes to go in one's head. So all of those things, they haven't totally gone, but I think we have to be wary that isn't the case, and we have to certainly appreciate what we might be losing.
I'd like you to speculate a little. You touch on this in the book, but why do you suppose humans first started making maps, whether they were etched in stone or maybe just sketched in the dirt and lost forever to history?
Well, it's interesting. People like Richard Dawkins have this theory that it was the creation of maps that really made us human to begin with. Maps existed before language, and in a way they were a form of language. So, you know, if you wanted to hunt an elk in the African plains, what you would do is you would engage other people to help you with this. And the way you would do that is you would draw really a map in the, you know, in the dirt or on a cave wall or somewhere, and say, well, actually, this is where the elk lies, this is where we are, this is where we have to be very quiet and creep up on them, and this is where we throw our spears or whatever it is. And so, you know, Dawkins's view, and this is shared by many other anthropologists as well, I think, is that this was the thing that made our brains grow. The ability to read maps, draw maps, made them grow from just apes into Homo sapiens. That was the bridge, really, and that was maps. Now, we know now from experiments that have been done on cab drivers, amongst others, that maps do expand our brains. That if you are an experienced taxi driver and you've got the whole of, you know, Wisconsin in your head, that part of your brain, the hippocampus, which stores that information, will expand and it will grow. Now, that's, of course, another thing that we may use if we rely totally on GPS and, you know, satellite navigation in our cars, then that part of our brain will shrink, I think, and maybe kind of turn off. And I think that's another great loss. So it is, you know, maps aren't just a kind of handy tool. They are absolutely integral, I think, to our whole lives, not only the way we get about, but the way we think about space and the way we think about our place in the world.
That's Simon Garfield talking about his new book, On the Map. We are talking about maps, how we use them, why we love them as functional objects and as things of beauty and things to inspire our imagination and maybe even grow our brain. We'll get to your calls in just a few minutes. You can also email talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a holiday treat. Carl Schmidt on Chapter Day at 12:30, reading from the complete shorter fiction of Anthony Trollope. They've selected a few stories to read in this holiday season. Sounds like a lot of fun. That's today at 12:30. This hour, I'm talking to Simon Garfield about his new book, On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks. You can join in. Do you have a favorite map? Do you have something up on your wall? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll take a call now from Vicki in Edgerton. Hi, Vicki.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just had to call in because I work for a very small state agency, downtown Madison. It's the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, and our agency is a repository for all the original plat maps from when the state was surveyed back in the early 1800s. So these surveyors, you know, went out on foot and surveyed the entire state. I think it took them a little over 30 years. So if there's ever a dispute on property lines or, you know, where, you know, lines are at, the surveyors have to come all the way back to our agency, take a look at those original plat maps, and then, you know, move forward looking at other resurveys that were done because, you know, it was pretty, you know, a pretty manual
sure.
process because they used a chain that was, I want to say, like 60-some feet long with so many links in it, and that's how they measured, you know, the land. And it's actually a very, very interesting process. And so the surveyors were out surveying the land, and they would send their field notes back to the cartographer's office, and someone who never walked the land would read those field notes, interpret them, and then draw the maps. So you can, with our maps, you can see how all these rivers in Wisconsin, especially the Wisconsin River, how it flowed naturally back in the early settlement of Wisconsin.
Wow, what a great historical series of documents, Vicki. And Simon Garfield, she brings up probably one of the biggest uses of maps in recent history, maybe going back further, setting up land boundaries for property owners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's when maps really took off. It was that, you know, the classic thing that, you know, it was a need for something that made something happen. It wasn't just a kind of a wish to draw pretty maps. And actually what Vicki's describing is really familiar to me on a grander scale, the way that France, the whole of France and the whole of England was surveyed, and Ireland as well was surveyed, was pretty much exactly that way. At around the time, the beginning of the 1800s, people went out with chains and, as you say, took field notes, and then someone skilled in cartography and visual sort of spatialization drew them on paper. And the process obviously took ages, and you had to walk the line, and there wasn't very much. There weren't very many alternatives. I mean, you could go on a horse, I suppose, especially if the terrain wasn't sort of too built up. But it was a fantastically slow process, and it was that classic thing of trying to paint a bridge. You know, by the time you got to the end of the survey, the first part of it was fantastically out of date, and you know, had grown up, and there were new avenues and new streets, and new buildings had gone up, and an endless prayer, you know, process of the whole thing. But fascinating, and I imagine kind of beautiful to look at. The original documents must be absolutely fantastic.
And one theme I pick up in your book is there are often a lot of maps that didn't just change we think of the world, but in a way change history. And these plat maps, these survey maps, were critical to the rise of our modern economy, to know who owned this piece of land and could my sheep go over there? Nope, that's off my boundary. Or can I plant this or put my factory here? These are pivotal in our modern economy,
yeah,
aren't they?
Absolutely. And they were sort of especially useful because obviously that's the way that the governments, local and national, raised their taxes, really, you know. A lot of these things existed purely for that reason as well. You know, you had to pay a certain amount of tax if you owned a certain amount of land. whether you build, you know, whether you actually build on it or not. And yeah, hugely important to sort of our economy. And it obviously, you know, as we know, wars, many wars have broken out over boundary and border disputes. And it sort of, you know, it's obviously is the case now in the Middle East in particular. You know, who owns what, who ever owned what, who was supposed to own what, who was given what by what God, you know, and those sort of continue. Yeah, fantastically important to the economy and really kind of sort of everything else. It was a case very much of, you know, this is mine. This is something that I'm going to earn money from, and I put my name to it. And the problem was, of course, you know, again, as we said at the top of the show, it's sort of, there is no such thing really as a subjective map. There's no such thing as an object.
Right.
So essentially, you know, maps are drawn by individuals, and often, you know, as Vicky says as well, you know, they have an objective in mind, and that objective is necessarily to pay more tax, pay less tax, to kind of please the people who own the land or the government. So they are open to influence, open to bribery. Would do a little bit of downright, you know, gerrymandering and manipulation of borders and lands as well. And there's no better example, really. Of, you know, we tend to, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we would read a book, let's say a biography of a famous politician or president, and say, and you know, and you kind of read that, and you think, okay, well, that's fascinating, but you know that actually this is probably one person's side. You know, this is an argument from one political side. But yet we tend to see maps as sort of far more sort of truthful, definitive objects, and actually they're sort of anything but. It is still very much in a kind of an individual, one person's view. I'm not saying that all maps lie or all maps set out to be corrupt in some way, but we need to treat maps with, you know, a certain amount of trepidation and cynicism as well, I think.
Well, that we'll get to calls again in a minute, but this seems like a good time to bring up the story of how California was an island for some decades. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, an extraordinary thing, really. I mean, when California was first appeared on the map, it was clearly part of, you know, of the West Coast and of the mainland, and that was fine, and everyone was happy with that. Until, I'm going to consult my chapter now on that, because I obviously want to make sure that I get the exact dates. But the extraordinary thing about that was that, after a while, California sort of just began to kind of drift free. And for about, oh gosh, I don't know, you know, 200 years or so, and I will give you the exact dates now.
It was in the 1650s. I've got my copy of
your
book here, too.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, so it's exactly right. So the name California first appeared on a map in 1541, and it was actually fairly well mapped. I mean, it was quite sort of accurate, really. But then between about 1650 and 1657, there were maps that showed that it was sort of drifting free, and it existed as a kind of floating island. And people did actually try to sail around California, as you would, like, sort of any nice holiday island on a yacht.
Circumnavigate California, yeah.
Exactly. Just go around the whole thing. And even though this was, as we know, an impossible feat, it didn't really occur to them to actually correct the maps when they kind of failed to do this. So in the Library of Congress, I think there are, a huge amount, more than 200 maps, separate individual maps, that show California as an island. And it was only in the 19th century, I think, when it was officially declared that California is not an island. And it was bad. So actually, the last map to show California as an island was published in Japan in 1865, which is, extraordinary, really. But I always think that these things are a bit like Wikipedia entries now, that, something is posted on there, and it's sort of taken as fact. So if you're composing a college essay and you read that someone was, died in a certain year, and they actually got that wrong on Wikipedia for whatever reason, maybe just a genuine error, or maybe they're trying to have fun with you or whatever, then that appears in 1,000 college essays until some bright spark actually realizes, no, that's wrong, and then hopefully Wikipedia is corrected. And it was the same with old maps. I mean, the idea of California as an island was probably the biggest case of something going totally wrong on a map for such a prolonged period of time. But there are many others, and I talk about other mistakes in the book that are just perpetuated because people, now we would fly over it and see that wasn't the case, and we would correct it very swiftly. But then people didn't travel so much. News travels very slowly. Correct maps were very, very important if you wanted a kind of trade, but otherwise, if you just went by it, you probably wouldn't think twice of kind of correcting it, especially if you went by on the kind of far side, as it were, rather than the bit that was supposed to be, clear water between California and the West Coast. And so, these things just persisted. And I love that. But there were other, there are kind of other examples of classic. And half of me sort of wishes that this was sort of, that there were more of these even now. Unfortunately, the satellites above us kind of pretty much see everything, and as I said, things get corrected pretty soon. Of course, I'm sure we'll talk towards perhaps the end of the program about the classic example of things being wrong on Apple Maps. And although I do have an iPhone, and I've got nothing against Apple, I was absolutely appalled about how bad those maps are. But it did make me think of, examples like California as an island. You kind of think, oh well, that's one good thing. At least we're still sort of fouling up the world in a cartographic way.
Rob Verrett talking to Simon Garfield about his new book, On the Map. Back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. Alan in Eau Claire County is with us. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. This is my kind of program.
All right.
Mr. Garfield, I suspect you're the sort of gentleman that we could sit down over a couple of glasses of ale and have a long conversation. although I can be much more succinct and just make two points and then a footnote, because I'd really like to hear your response. The first point is, and I should preface this by saying, I've been a wilderness backpacker and a canoeist, and I live in a cabin in the woods, and very much, I guess I've been called a naturalist. But I've been all over the lower 48 in Canada. It is sad to me that people seem to be giving up the opportunities found in being lost and the opportunities found in getting your way out of being lost. That's the first point. The second point is you can actually discover where you are. I'm a great fan of U.S. Geological Service maps. I've got them all over the place. And, I can tell you, based on my study of where the prehistoric sea in Wisconsin was, that I live, in effect, on a prehistoric island next, surrounded by higher islands, which are now called ridges. So studying those maps and the history of where the ancient sea was, I've been able to figure out, well, what was this place? And then I'll just footnote this and get off the air. I have two maps on the wall of my cabin loft. One is an annotated map of Wales, because I'm mostly Welsh and Scottish. And the other is a map of Middle Earth, which was part of Tolkien's genius, was to create a world and map it. Good luck to you, sir. I'm going to get your book, and I'll get off the air and listen. Thank you so much.
Alan, thanks a lot. Oh, where do we start with that?
Exactly. I don't know. Wait, so what I mean, you're absolutely right about getting lost. And I say right at the end of the book, you know, that there is still a great advantage of getting lost. And, we can turn off our maps. You know, we don't have to have them on our phones or consult them on our phones. And, I can tell you at this, I'm sure you've seen a lot of park rangers in your time, quite recently, sort of despairing of people who travel without proper folding maps into parks and wildernesses, thinking somehow that their GPS is going to, you know, that their battery is going to last forever, and also that they will get a good satellite signal there. And obviously that isn't the case. And I just know from, you know, you mentioned Wales and Scotland, I just know from the experience here of mountain rescue guys who just think GPS is, in one sense, it's great because it does help them find people who are lost in terrible weather and bad mountains and all of that. And that's obviously very, very important. But there's a certain sort of naivety thing, you know, where people will think, well, you know, I've got an iPhone, therefore I'm going to be all right in any situation without a map, you know. And people who can't read maps as well, that's a whole other thing. So you're absolutely right. The idea of getting lost is great, but the idea of being able to read a map and find your way out of being lost, I think, is just as important. And obviously, the great thing about being lost is it helps you discover new places that you might not otherwise have found, you know. We only need to look at Columbus, you know, looking for, you know, sort of riches in the east and hitting South America. And we kind of know that's the value in getting lost, I think. And that happens all the time. What else? You know,
I was thinking we'd pick up Middle Earth in just a couple of minutes, actually. But I'll hold on to that thought. I want to get you mentioned Columbus, and I'm going to go to Claire in Mount Horeb now, who I think has something to say about Columbus and his maps. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hi. Actually, I'm currently reading a book called 1421 by Gavin Menzies, and I assume your guest has heard of him. And I'm just fascinated by the idea that the Chinese might have gotten to North America before Columbus, and what do you think? Is there anything he got wrong in this book? And I'd just like to hear what you have to say.
Gosh, well, I mean, I do have it on my shelf. I haven't read the book, so I can't go through all the arguments. But it is. I mean, it's absolutely a very valid. Argument. I talk in the book, the story that I talk about sort of, you know, the discovery, the pre-discovery of America, I suppose, goes back much, much earlier than 1421. It goes back to Viking times and something called the Vinland map, which is a whole other wonderful tale of how I suppose you would regard them as kind of Nordic people, knew of and sailed to essentially Newfoundland and found it rich in wine and called it Wineland or Vinland. And this was around sort of the year 1000. And there is a map that either does or does not show this clearly, and this map is at the Beinecke Library in Yale. So it's it's something that has been pored over for probably now the best part of 50 years by map scholars, looking at whether this is a genuine object or not. If it is, it's probably the most valuable map in the world. If not, people have been trying to work out why someone would want to fake this and fool people. Because if it isn't, it's certainly a wonderful fake. It's not something that you would be able to sort of cook up in an afternoon. And it certainly fooled a lot of people. And now the general thinking is that it's about probably 80% not real, and 20% of people believe that it is real, but it's still undetermined. So that's my favorite tale of the discovery of America, the possible discovery of America pre-Columbus. But the other book, the Gavin Menzies book, is although I haven't read it, it does come highly recommended by all who have.
But it is controversial, the idea that Chinese explorers were here before Columbus.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call and bringing that up, Claire. That's Simon Garfield, our guest this hour, talking about his new book, On the Map. More of your calls coming up and a quick trip to Middle Earth, maybe. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. Of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11, just because it's cold and snowy outside doesn't mean we can't spend time outdoors with the kids in our lives. Judith Sears-Passan talks with the author of a book that promotes the benefits of spending time outside with your kids each and every day. This hour, we're talking about maps with Simon Garfield, talking about his new book, On the Map. We'll get back to the phones now with George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hey, there's a map that came out about 25 years ago called the Peters Projection Map, which really kind of caused a stir because it showed the southern hemisphere as being much larger than the northern. So Africa ends up on the map being much, much bigger than it is. Europe is kind of reduced in size. And there's been quite a bit of controversy over this map and how accurate it is, and I wonder if your guests could comment on it.
Thanks for the call, George. And that's one of the big challenges you talk about in your book. How do you take a round world and put it on a rectangular map?
Exactly, and this was absolutely the problem that a man called Gerardus Mercator was trying to solve in the 16th century. So in 1569... he came up with what he hoped was a solution how do you put a three-dimensional world that we know to be roundish on a two-dimensional bit of paper that's going to help navigators and sailors sort of find their right way around the world. I'm sure Columbus would have found this fantastically useful a half century and more before. But what he did, in a not really a sort of malevolent way, I don't think, he sort of distorted the way the world looks. The Peters projection that your caller mentioned was really an attempt to sort of redirect the shape of the world and show the world in a different way. Now, that was very much a political map, because what it tried to do was to show that Mercator, which is still the standard map that we use in classrooms and Google Maps, in fact, sort of models its maps, if you look at Google Earth, on the Mercator projection. So it's sort of, it's still, many people regard as the best we've got. But Peters and others after him tried to show that actually what had happened was that places in the northern hemisphere, like Greenland, for instance, were given far too much weight and would actually appear on the map as the same size as Africa, whereas Africa is something like 14 times as large. So it had very major, errors on it, and Germany appears in the middle of the world, which it really isn't, I don't think, but it's what we're used to. And there was a fantastic episode of The West Wing that I'm sure a lot of listeners will recall, where C.J. Craig is called into a meeting, basically a mythical or made-up organization, but supporting the Peters projection, tries to kind of show how nothing they think is, nothing they know is actually where they think it is. Mm-hmm. And they can't handle that. And the attempt is to try and persuade Martin Sheen as the president to try and, change every school map as a result of their campaign. The problem is that Peters also distorts other things. That there are, I don't know, there are a huge amount of different projections in the world with different ways of lurking and shaping the world. But each of these have a slight, you know, distortion because it's, in effect, you know, that's why we have globes. You know, globes are round and they show the world pretty much as they are in a far more accurate way. But it's very, very difficult to show anything that's spherical on a rectangular piece of paper.
Thanks for the call, George. We've got Gary in Bellefonte, Illinois now. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. I'm a truck driver, and, I use the map every day to back up my GPS.
So you use both. You've got the GPS going, but you don't. You double-check it with the map before you head out on the road?
Oh, yes. Because a lot of times GPS is just plain wrong, and I grew up trusting maps a whole lot more. I learned to read maps in the military, you know, so I'm one of the few people still around that knows how to read a map.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Gary.
Yeah, so, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, first of all, what a wise thing to do, you know. There are many, many cases of someone putting their GPS in the car or something, and putting in, a Springfield somewhere in the States, and then ending up at a totally different Springfield, and not knowing, until they've traveled 300 miles or something, you know, out of the way they ought to be going. I mean, it's extraordinary that kind of trust that he talks about. You know, we trust old maps, but we also trust GPS. In fact, I think we trust GPS even more. It's like a kind of blind faith, but absolutely right. You know, I mean, the people make, you know, there was human error and there was satellite error, and ultimately it's humans who have to align and realign the satellite and make them into a way that we can understand, and our mistakes are made, and maps change, of course. You know, the world changes all the time. So a wise thing to change, a wise thing to check GPS on a bigger map. I think that's kind of the best advice of the hour, I think. And then, you know, sort of his point about he wonders whether he isn't the only person left who can read a map. I mean, there's a certain kind of truth in that, because my kids, have this attitude, the same sort of attitude, I suppose, that they have in news gathering. They kind of think, why should I pay $2 or a pound or whatever to go out and buy, you know, go out in the rain, buy a newspaper, bring it back, blah, 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 get out my hands inky, when I can get it all free instantly at home on my computer. And unfortunately, the same goes for maps. And I think now the way that the map reading is taught in school is sort of almost with a kind of nostalgic, sort of historical bent, rather than a this is going to be really useful in your life. So I think there's now a realization that kids growing up don't really need to read a map in the same way. In the same way that maybe we don't think shorthand is interesting, or you know, going back 500 years, we no longer have to plow a field. You know, so I don't think. I don't want to sound anti-progress or anti-tech in any way, because I'm not. But I think we have to be wary that, you know, that things are handed to us on high by Apple or by Microsoft or by Dell or whoever it is, you know, Google now, and we kind of we have to be careful not to forget, you know, everything that we've learned in the past.
One of our earlier callers mentioned Middle Earth, and I promised we'd get back to that. I didn't want to leave it till too late. The idea of fantasy maps and Tolkien and the map of Middle Earth was one of the most notable examples. Talk a little bit about fictional maps like that.
Yeah, hugely important. I mean, my sort of pet theory, I suppose, is that the maps that we learn as kids from the, you know, the fly leaves of books or when they fold out of a book, that someone like Tolkien that we read in Alice in Wonderland or Winnie the Pooh even, or, you know, any of those classic kind of kids' books, those are the ones that actually stay with us forever. Those are ingrained in our in our brains, burnt into our brains, really. So I think a lot of people will be watching, you know, the new Hobbit film, for instance, and think, actually, no, that doesn't lie in that's not the right location of that hill in relation to the other hill or whatever it is. And because but fantastically important, and those are the things that create, you know, our love of. I love of maps, I think, as much as anything else. You know, I mean, the classic one, which I talk quite a lot about in the book, is Treasure Island. You know, the map of Treasure Island, which is really the map that sort of made that great myth in our minds of the sort of slightly creaky, leathery map with X marks the spot on it, you know, and that comes from, you know, that comes from literature, and there's a really nice tale from that when the original map was drawn up of Treasure Island, it was put in the post with the manuscript of the book, and the book arrived, but the map never did, and so Robert Louis found it very, very difficult to redraw the map. So he wrote the book with the map in his, you know, by his side. And then when he tried to redraw it again for the book, he found he couldn't really do it quite the same.
A lost treasure map. We'll get one more call from Tom and Nina. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yes, thanks for taking my call. The question that I have, or the observation, is sometimes errors in maps can be beneficial. And are there errors in maps that could be that you found in your research that are beneficial? For example, in northern Minnesota, there's a tract of old-growth timber called the Lost 40. And in the 1880s, when northern Minnesota was being plotted, an error was made by the survey team in which a lake was mapped out as being significantly larger than it actually was. And therefore, the acreage that was included in the lake as an error, that was never leased to the timber companies for harvest. So as a consequence, there's over a 100-acre area in northern Minnesota that is now virgin old-growth timber that's being used for research purposes. So that's a benefit of a error in maps.
Great. I'll cut in there because we're short on time, Tom, but what a great example. What do you think about that, Simon Garfield?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of agree. You know, I like to have a slightly romantic view on this as well, and you kind of walk around, you know, as you said, I live in the London, and you wish there were a few more of those errors, a few more sort of unspoiled heathland here that you know, had been measured way too big and had been assigned to someone rather than had been built up. And I think that's great. And in a way, that speaks, I think, you know, to the romance of maps and to the human element of maps as well. You know, it's something that we, you know, that we kind of love, and hand-drawn maps, I think, are making a comeback, which I think, again, is that kind of human, personal thing. I think we've almost had enough of digital maps, and my favorite maps, I think, are the ones that we draw ourselves on envelopes to friends to be able to reach a certain place, and I'd like to bring that back, really. This is my campaign for the hour, to put down your digital maps and draw a map by hand on a bit of paper.
Well, we've just got a minute and a half left, and I've left a lot of uncharted territory that you cover in your book. Is there a favorite map of yours that we haven't touched on this hour?
I think it goes back to errors, which is nice, really. I think my favorite map is from 1798, which is a map of Africa, which shows something called the Mountains of Kong. Now, there was a region called Kong on the map in Africa, but what happened was that a famous and a highly regarded British cartographer went there at the end of the 18th century, saw a mountain or a hill, saw something similar far off, and drew across the entire western belt of Africa a huge chain called the Mountains of Kong. This, again, existed on maps for 100 years, until someone went there and found that these didn't actually exist.
So, Mountains of Kong and the Island of California. That's where we'll have to leave it. Simon Garfield, thank you very much for joining us.
I enjoyed it, Rob. It was great.
It's been a lot of fun. Simon Garfield, he's author of a number of books, and his newest is On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. Thanks a lot to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program. Thanks to you for all your great calls and for listening. And have a great and happy new year. Coming up next hour, Judith Sears-Poisson looks at outdoor recreation, even in the bitter cold, and then plant-based meals. That's coming up. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on this New Year's Day here on the Ideas Network.